You're listening to FemWonk, a podcast about inclusion, policy, politics, and current affairs. I'm your host, Katie Davey. Thanks for tuning in. We're back after a few weeks off, and I could not be more thrilled about the conversation we're about to have today. I'm joined by Anjum and Carmina, the two authors of the recently released Feminist Economic Recovery Plan. We're going to get into the weeds today, which, as you all know, is one of my favorite things to do. But this is such a timely conversation. We're recording it on Tuesday night, so we're going to spend some time also talking about some of the recent changes in government and how that relates to the plan. But without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Anjum and Carmina to tell us a little bit more about what the Feminist Economic Recovery Plan is.
So on July 28th, so less than a month ago, YWC Canada and the Institute for Gender and the Economy released a Feminist Economic Recovery Plan for Canada. So this is actually the first nationally focused feminist economic recovery plan in the world. And it's something that has, you know, 8 pillars and 27 recommendations. And I would say at the heart of it, the core message is, this is a very unique recession. This is a very unique crisis globally, economically, socially, and otherwise. And so we really need to have tailored solutions. And for us, that means having a feminist approach. That means putting at the center cis and trans women, two-spirit people, and gender diverse people. And so that's what this plan offers. And we have so many different things within the plan that we can kind of build on and kind of unpack. But I would say at the core of it, the key message is you can't have any type of economic recovery if you're not centering the needs of cis and trans women, two-spirit, and gender diverse people. It's something that built off of the work that YWC Canada did and the Institute for Gender and the Economy did. And we kind of came together and produced this.
It's so amazing to be the first in the world. I think that's such an amazing contribution, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, if other countries take this direction and what that looks like, and particularly, you know, the civil society and the contributions that they can make. Carmina, can you tell me a little bit about what some of those pillars are of the plan itself?
Yeah, absolutely. So as Anjum mentioned, we do have 8 different pillars in the Feminist Economic Recovery Plan. And they definitely address all different parts of the economy and the way in which the pandemic has affected different groups within the economy. So one of the things we started with was intersectionality. As Anjum mentioned, we really wanted to focus on the ways in which women, gender diverse people have been affected by the pandemic, but also to have a very strong intersectional focus with that. So we know, for example, that racialized people been very much affected by the pandemic, both in terms of health outcomes, as well as in terms of the fact that their racialized people are concentrated in essential jobs. So just having an intersectional focus throughout the report was very, very important to us, focusing on the different social identities that people experience and how the pandemic has affected those groups differently.
We also focused on care work as a very important part of the plan. Just the ways in which care work has been shown to be devalued throughout our economy during the pandemic. We focused on decent work and how we've really seen how people, there's a divide between people who have good jobs, that is jobs where they can work remotely and still have income security, and those who are not able to have that security. We also talked about the rise in domestic violence, which has become very clear in the pandemic due to the lockdown policies that have gone on. We talked about small businesses and the importance of making sure that businesses run by women and marginalized people are bolstered, as well as infrastructure, key infrastructure throughout the pandemic, that people need, we really focus on that. So having access to internet, having access to clean water, having access to housing. That's just some of the examples of pillars, the things that we focused on through these pillars in the report.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've been hearing, you know, bits and pieces, whether it's in the media or from academics and folks like that are contributing to the conversation about many of those different pieces. So tell me a bit about actually the process behind deciding to produce this report. What did that look like, and you know, why did you decide to do it? I guess, I mean, it's a great report, so I know why. I hopefully, you know why you decided, but I'd love the inside look of that.
Yeah, so I can definitely share from like the YWCA perspective, and then Carmina, if you want to share the Institute for Gender and the Economy. So I feel like in many ways, the plan was like born on March 11th. And you might be like, what is March 11th? Well, that's the day that the World Health Organization called COVID-19 a global pandemic. And for folks who don't know, listeners at home, 2020 is actually a very significant year in the gender equity space. It is the 25th year anniversary of the Beijing Declaration and Platform for Action. So many civil society organizations around the globe were actually in March planning on coming to New York City to talk about the United Nations Commission on Status of Women, commemorate this critical anniversary, but also talk about what's next. How do we actually make sure, you know, this comprehensive platform for gender equality, we're actually realizing that in our different individual countries. And Canadian civil society, for example, in 2019 had actually put out their version of like what has happened and actually how far Canada still has to go. So there was this big momentum this year in particular to talk about gender equality in many different ways. And so when the pandemic hit, and one of the first UN events it hit was the United Nations Commission on Status of Women, you know, it was definitely, you know, the connections between COVID and gender equality, you could see it right from the beginning, just on the symbolic or organizational UN kind of track of work. But then on the ground, across the country, YWCA, for example, has essential services. So we provide housing and shelter. We provide childcare programs and employment and training programs. And as soon as COVID-19 hit across the different provinces and territories, our work transformed. So we were seeing, you know, the rise in domestic violence. We were seeing how you can't really restart the economy if you don't address the need for childcare and investing in childcare. So we were seeing this all across the ground. And part of our mandate is how do we, you know, show what's happening across the country and bring that to the attention of decision makers and policymakers. So we actually did a virtual series called Gender Equity During a Pandemic. And on April 1st, I remember very clearly, we held our first online town hall just to talk to people across the country. Like, you know, what do we need to recover? What do we need to reimagine? And using that to kind of think about our policy recommendations to the federal government and, you know, if need be, other levels of government. And then shortly thereafter, a couple weeks after that town hall, we saw Hawaii, the Status of Women Commission in Hawaii, release the Hawaii Report, which was the first ever feminist economic recovery plan for that state. And so for us, we were like, okay, we have a pan-Canadian perspective. What does that look like if we look at a national level? And we knew the Institute for Gender and the Economy was also doing similar conversations, similar work. And so we thought it would be great to partner. So maybe I'll pass it over to Carmina to share a bit of her insights and her kind of perspective.
Yeah, thanks, Anjum. Like Anjum said, we basically had been seeing as the pandemic progressed, the ways in which women and gender diverse people were being specifically affected by the pandemic and its outcomes. And so we had actually created, we're based in the Robbins School of Management. So we're an academic institute, very much based in research. And we had created a short piece on the gender impacts of COVID-19, just briefly looking at the different ways, and this was still early in the pandemic in March, just briefly looking at the different ways in which research and data was coming out with these very clear gender impacts, as well as impacts on racialized people, impacts on the LGBTQ+ community and so forth. So we really wanted to put that out there, that perspective out there, and show how definitely different groups are being affected in different ways. And we too had been attentive to the Hawaii Feminist Economic Recovery Plan and thought it was a great idea, just such a sort of transformative document to put forward in terms of policy during this very crucial time. We just, as Andrew mentioned, connected with the YWCA and brought our research and academic expertise together with the amazing work that YWCA is doing on the ground in terms of service provision and so on, and came together to produce sort of our own version of what we were seeing. It was really important to talk about at this time.
Yeah, and you know, it sounds like that was also you know, from the timeline, if I'm remembering correctly, right around the time as well that, you know, the term she session was coined. There we go. Term and coined. I'm mixing my words. I'm trying to mash them all together tonight. It's all good. It's, I don't know, late in the day. It's my excuse. But yeah, it seems like these conversations were happening right around the same time that we were seeing a lot of public data really pointing to how badly women were being impacted. You know, I was really struck actually in the report by the fairly long list of folks that you consulted. And I thought it was really, you know, obviously excellent for that to happen, but also really impactful that you actually showed, here are all the contributors, here are all the folks that we're leveraging, here are all the folks that we engaged. So in such a short period of time, I'd love to hear a bit more about, you know, the actual process of pulling this report together and authoring this report. You know, it's so robust, and it seems like you had so many conversations, but it was done in quite a short time. So I'd love to know, you know, what that looked like, really.
Yeah, sometimes when I look at the document, I'm just like, wow, what we were able to do in a matter of weeks, really. It was, you know, especially during pandemic, was very challenging, but at the end, so worth it and so really strengthened the final version. And every single contribution, every type of piece of feedback we got, we like went back into, you know, Carmina and I, we talked about it at length, but we also talked about it at length with our strategic leads. So Maya Roy, the CEO of YWC Canada, and Dr. Sarah Kaplan, the director of the Institute for Gender and the Economy. And we really like, we had like bi-weekly meetings every Tuesday, every Friday at 9 a.m. where we would just talk about this like for weeks and weeks and weeks. So I think one of the things that worked for us is we just carved out time for it. And we're like, this is important. We're going to meet, and we're going to meet more than just once a week. We're going to meet multiple times a week just to get this right. I think what also, you know, one of the things I think from my perspective, and maybe Carmina, you feel the same. I think part of it is before this pandemic happened, both of our organizations were known for, you know, this type of work, this type of analysis for us on the policy end, for GATE on the research end. And so when we, you know, picked up the phone, you know, proverbially, and we're like, hey, we have this project. We would love for you to take a look at it and see if we're on the right track. People trusted us because they knew that there was this alignment in value, but also that there was this alignment in purpose, because all of us, you were talking a bit about the different types of conversations happening across the country and frankly, across the world. Everyone's in it for the same thing. We need to address the gendered impacts. We need to address the intersectional impacts of this crisis. So if this is a contribution that can be a vehicle for a positive change, I think everybody wanted to support that. Because the thing is, we don't want people who are like deeply invested on getting this plan right and getting it as, you know, to the level we could in a short amount of time, because they saw the power in it. They saw the power in the coalition, you know, between the two organizations, but also the potential precedents it could set in Canada and globally. So I think people were just really invested. And I think at the heart of it, and maybe in a very truly feminist way, it was a lot of consultation, a lot of relationship building, and a lot of collaboration.
Yeah, no, I think that's so important. And I was particularly struck when I read through the document to see, you know, or I guess kind of what stood out to me was in many cases, I had seen one or two of the kind of individual recommendations, perhaps, you know, worded differently or what have you, in many different places and in many different, you know, circles and spaces and kind of all of those things. But it really was the first time that you see all of these really complementary and supportive recommendations that are kind of building on each other, pulled together in one place. Carmina, maybe tell me a bit about how you came to some of those recommendations.
Yeah, so I think it was really just such a great collaborative process, in the sense that we all have our different areas of expertise and knowledge within this very broad feminist economic kind of space. So from my own side at the Institute for Gender and the Economy, we are constantly talking about care work, the devaluation of care work,
women in the labor force, as well as decent work and access to jobs. And not so much in the sense of things like infrastructure or even domestic violence, just because we're very much working on those solely work, job or work-related issues. Although we did definitely have materials to do with those, just not as a prominent focus. So just coming together with YWCA Canada, who definitely works on some of those issues that we at the Institute didn't have as much expertise in, was just a really productive and I think fruitful collaboration in order to, as you said, get those, that range of policy recommendations. And we definitely are super thankful to all the reviewers who were able to provide input, as you said, because they brought their own very specific expertise. We had economists look at it. We had people who work in different parts of civil society looking at it. So I really think, as Angie said, it was great to have everybody's different voices come together in such a short time to get those very rather broad range of policy recommendations.
Now let's jump into those recommendations a little bit. So, I mean, you've both heard this as many times as I've had, but folks will often, you know, say, oh, that's not an issue that impacts women, or that's not a feminist issue, or, you know, about whatever. I actually remember I did, you know, a media interview a few years ago, and I talked about, just in passing, I mentioned how climate change was a gendered issue. And my dad, of course, dutifully, was listening to the interview. And he kind of said to me, he's like, you know, I totally followed everything you said until you said, you know, climate change is a gendered issue. What does that mean? And so, you know, I loved, you know, you mentioned infrastructure. Very few people would naturally see what the gendered impacts of infrastructure are, for example. And, you know, I note, of course, you've got the national housing strategy within your recommendations, prioritizing clean drinking water, addressing broadband access. So tell me a little bit more about, you know, what the gendered impacts of some of these, I'll call them non-traditional kind of gendered issues.
So I'll say, you know, it's interesting, right? This whole infrastructure conversation, because the traditional playbook, when there is an economic crisis, a recession, let's say, is literally build back better, like invest in, you know, the built environment, whether it's like roads, bridges. And primarily it's because often in previous recessions, it was men or sectors where there are more men working that are traditionally impacted by economic crisis. So think construction, et cetera. And so people, you know, the traditional playbook has been invest in these sectors so we can bring back employment numbers for men. For us, we kind of looked at that and kind of flipped it on its head, or kind of thought about, what do we actually need to invest in? So I come from a public health background. And one of the things that was like, you know, in my mind throughout this pandemic is like, if we only invested in the things that are considered the social determinants of health, we would have been in a better position with this pandemic. Mind you, I, you know, salute the incredible public health professionals that have really, you know, shown us just incredible impact and efficacy, but I think we could have been even better if we had invested in things like housing. So one of the first recommendations is stay home. Well, that requires you to actually have a safe and affordable place to live. And unfortunately, in this country, there is such a dearth of affordable housing. And we're seeing this, right? That's sometimes the reason why people come to our shelters across the country. And then also that is something that impacts the economic security, for example, for women. And there is some correlation regarding gender-based violence, right? Looking at housing availability and just security of women in all aspects of their life. And so for us, naturally at the YWCA, we saw like housing is such a critical need. And so that was one of the areas we thought absolutely we need to focus on. And part of it is housing and homelessness looks different for women and girls. But at the core of it, to really address the housing situation in this country, it's not enough to invest in our shelters. And, you know, we saw $50 million from the federal government, and that was great for addressing the rise in domestic violence during this pandemic and investing in shelters. But really, if we really want to build back better, we have to create that affordable housing for everyone. So that was a crucial piece. And then when it comes to internet access, so I think we're seeing this very clearly during the pandemic. Every aspect of our life is now online. And so if we really want to have lives that are economically secure, socially secure, for people to, you know, not experience social isolation, internet access is so crucial. Even all of these income supports that the federal government and other levels of government have been pushing out. For many, there is an assumption that people have access to internet. Yeah, so that's something that we saw. So we know generally across the country, we're doing quite well for a G7 nation, but we know that there's places where people have been left behind, particularly rural communities, as well as many communities, for example, Indigenous communities are experiencing a lot of inability to access affordable high-speed internet. So for us, that was something, you know, for economic recovery, when we think about the jobs of the future, a lot of it has to do with the internet as well. So that was part of the reason why we focused on those elements of infrastructure. But again, you know, another element, and perhaps we'll get into this later, is the social infrastructure. So that was another crucial element of our plan as well.
Carmina, you mentioned that your work focuses on care work, and you know, we've seen some really dramatic impacts, particularly on women during this pandemic for tons of reasons on care work. So I'd love for you to tell me a bit more about, you know, what kind of the lens was in the report on that piece. You know, obviously there's excellent recommendations around childcare and things like that, but I'd love to hear a bit more about, you know, really from your perspective, what that impact has looked like.
Yeah, so I think during the pandemic, it's really come to the fore how undervalued the care economy is in general. And of course, that poses huge issues in terms of just gender inequality, because we know that women and gender diverse people, and particularly women who are Black, Indigenous, and people of color, are the ones who are doing the majority of care work. And that means both unpaid care work and paid care work. So what we really wanted to put forward in this plan was how necessary it is moving forward to ensure that care work is valued. And by that, we mean we need to ensure that people have access to affordable and accessible childcare, as well as elder care, that though the workers who are in those jobs are paid fairly, that they have access to protections. And that means both social and financial. So having access to paid sick leave, ensuring that their income is secure, and so forth. And we've really seen through the pandemic that when we don't have these things, then the cracks in our society's foundation really show, so to speak. So we've seen that women are exiting the labor force at higher rates than men, especially women who have young children, because that burden of having to work, for example, from home while also having to watch your child is just unsustainable. And it's still women who are doing most of that work. It's not men who are taking on the majority of that work. So in terms of economic recovery, if that issue is not taken into consideration, then it's very hard to see how there will be a strong economic recovery, because if we have women exiting the labor force, we have these very important parts of our economy, elder care homes and childcare, that aren't being properly funded and their workers aren't protected, then if we're still going to be continually vulnerable to crises like this pandemic. And we really wanted to emphasize that these care must be better funded. It must be prioritized by the government if we're going to have any change on this front.
Yeah. So, you know, this obviously also relates to social infrastructure, right? As Anjum just kind of alluded to, but I think it's so interesting as well. We talked about what typical or what our last kind of economic recoveries have looked like. And it has been, you know, fairly dramatic investments in sectors that were more heavily employed men. However, we have all this data. We've been seeing it through, whether it's Stats Can, whether it's academics, whether it's practitioners, telling us that women and diverse folks are being impacted dramatically and young people. Mm-hmm. However, we've seen virtually no movement on childcare. And further to that, you know, school is supposed to start in, what, 2 weeks? And we still have some pretty, you know, shoddy at best back to school plans. What does that tell you about government priorities?
I must say, you hit the nail on the head, right? Like, the question is, you know, oftentimes the pushback is there's not enough data, there's not enough studies, there's not enough information. And so that was part of the rationale why we put this plan together, is to kind of consolidate that all. You know, you can't ignore it. And I think part of it is just a devaluation. So Carmina spoke about the devaluation of the care economy. And part of it is who makes up the care economy? It's women, it's gender diverse people, it's people of color, it's Black and Indigenous folks. And so are we seeing that, you know, what we're seeing with the care economy and the lack of care there, you know, whoever makes up that economy, we're seeing that across the board, that lack of care. And so it really does give you pause. But I have to say, and Carmina was talking about this quite a bit, the care economy is what has been saving us during this crisis. It is the sector that has continued to chug along. And in fact, it is the sector we need to get right, whether it is actually childcare or schooling, right? Education, that is a form of care. For us to all get back to work, right? And so, you know, one quick thing I wanted to mention is, you know, we saw dramatic losses in jobs for women, particularly in tourism, hospitality, retail, et cetera. And so I think part of it is care offers an opportunity. It's a more resilient sector, right? So perhaps we should invest more. And I think one of the things I would also argue is care does not need to be feminized. It has been historically because of the patriarchy and, you know, the historical socialization. But I think there's an opportunity here to start to ensure that all genders participate in the care economy, right? It's not just also about that institutional type of care like childcare or elder care. It's also about thinking about how do we create caring workplaces across the board, right? You know, the one thing I worry about during this crisis, in addition to the gendered impacts and the racialized impacts and on equity seeking communities, is also this other echo pandemic, which is mental health, right? And so we're seeing also when we don't get things like care right, that actually has issues down the line. But to Katie, to answer your question, I think at the core of it is a devaluation of women. And it's hard to say this, but I think that is what we're seeing. And what I'm hearing from other civil society organizations, it's interesting, right? Like a lot of the gender equity organizations that are trying to fight this issue, they're also experiencing the very systems that they're trying to address, which is, for example, they might be also dealing with those multiple care responsibilities and work, but also their organizations are being underfunded. So we're seeing also this, you know, the sector that's trying to address these issues is also facing the gendered impacts. So I'll leave it there. But I think in short, we're seeing devaluation across the board.
Yeah, and it's so interesting because again, like we've got the data, but it's not just the data of the pandemic. We can see just even from Quebec that the best economic policy is actually investing in childcare, right? Like Quebec has one of the highest, and folks correct me, but it might be the highest rate of women employed in normal times. And I don't know if it's the world, it might be, but it's something crazy like that. Right. And so many folks point to their accessible childcare as one of the main reasons for that. So, you know, when we talk about economics, this is the bread and butter, right? This is getting mm-hmm. folks into the workforce. So yeah, it's been interesting that the conversation has really still continued to kind of stay off of the political agenda. So it'd be interesting to see how that shifts. And actually, you know, a perfect example of how that might shift is, you know, we're recording this on Tuesday evening. Today is a historic day in Canada. We've now got our first ever woman to hold the finance minister position with Minister Chrystia Freeland, which, you know, I think is a great signal. I think it's also super interesting that she's also a person who has written a book about the plutocracy. So, you know, hopefully we'll see some stuff around income inequality as well. But, you know, what does that you know, what does that signal look like for this plan? Is it, you know, does it leave you with hope, or are you, is it status quo?
You know, something that we talk about in the plan is diverse voices in decisions. So we do see that people of diverse backgrounds and women and gender diverse people are not very well represented in government policy making positions across the board. So in that sense, I think, you know, we can have hope in the sense that, okay, this is the first woman who's taking this position. That's something to notice. That's definitely something to, you know, discuss and hope that will facilitate the changes that we've been hoping for. At the same time, of course, we always have to consider, you know, it's important to hold politicians accountable for these changes that we're asking for. It's important to ensure that we don't assume that just because there is a woman in a position of power doesn't automatically mean that, you know, we're going to get all these amazing changes. That being said, I mean, I am always happy to see more diversity in positions of power, and that always gives me more hope for the future in terms of different policy making, in terms of change making.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. And Andrew, I'd love your thoughts as well, but could you also maybe speak to, you know, what's next for this plan in kind of that context as well?
Yeah, so definitely agree with Carmina. It's a very positive sign. You know, in our 153-year history as a country, right, it's the first time ever. And part of the reason why we had diverse voices and decisions is we need all people with all walks of life, all different experiences at the decision-making table, because then we'll actually get decisions that serve everyone. So this is, you know, a step towards that. That's not just tokenistic, that's actually truly meaningful and, you know, robust. That is what we want. And we want more of it, right? It can't just stop at the federal level. We need to see that across the board, right? Like, why is it it's 2020 and we still haven't seen that, right? In many ways, we're like, you know, remarking on it and, you know, very like celebratory, which is important, but it's also like, why has it taken this long? What are the barriers in place? You know, that's something also we want to talk about. And part of it is what we're seeing in the plan, right? Like, part of the reason why there's so many challenges to advancing into positions of leadership, into positions of decision making, is the lack of investment publicly in things like care services, right? Women traditionally, because of the lack of public services, have less time for other aspects of their life. And so that could be one of the barriers. In addition, the biases, right? You know, I'm curious to see the biases that we'll see, you know, not only in Canada that might, you know, rear their ugly head, but also south of the border, right? With the first African-American woman and woman of Indian descent to be vice president, right? I know perhaps this has been said about, you know, a range of different politicians. Oftentimes women who are seeking those positions of power are said too ambitious. But why is that a bad thing? And in fact, ambitious to create change, to support their communities, that's something I want to be behind. So that's one piece. In terms of the type of impact or resonance that this plan is having, we're seeing this across many orders of government, which has been really surprising and really something we've been appreciating, but also across different sectors. So let me just give you a quick run through. So federally, we've sent this plan out to all members of parliament, and we've also are looking at the status of women committee. We're looking at the finance committee to make sure these conversations are top of mind as those committees are discussing, for example, new economic measures. We're also really excited to see that there might be some push or development around a national action plan on gender-based violence. This is something, so it's interesting, right? A lot of people were curious, why are you talking about domestic violence or gender-based violence in an economic recovery plan? Well, for us and in the work that we do across the country and in the research world, gender-based violence costs the Canadian government money, costs our economy money, but also it actually impacts people's ability to feel safe and secure, to work, to socialize, to shop, to just be part of all different aspects of society. So that's something that needs to also have an economic consideration. Another aspect of the plan as well is addressing systemic racism. For similar reasons, Black and Indigenous communities have been telling us for decades what needs to change to support and address systemic barriers. And so that also will have an economic impact. We know that there are impacts around racism on mental health, for example. We know mental health is bad for the economy, mental illness. So that's something also that we've started to see. So, you know, one thing that actually got published today, in the province of Ontario, the official opposition's women's critic has actually taken our plan and is using that to say, hey, here's a plan that's calling for a feminist recovery. What are we doing in the province of Ontario? And she actually just published an op-ed today. So that was really surprising. You know, we didn't really have that much engagement. We didn't have a meeting, but people are getting inspired by the plan. Outside of Canada, I've heard of the Austria, for example, recently published their own take on a national feminist recovery plan. Same with Northern Ireland. And in fact, we were hearing from people from across the world that, wow, this is so cool. Like, can we do this in our own community? We're like, yes, please take the plan and think about how you can action it locally. And I think the interesting part is we're also seeing excitement from public service. So we've actually had public servants from Vancouver, from Halifax, from Toronto, reach out because they want to figure out internally, how do we do this? How do we do the policy work around this? So I think what we've offered is a resource, and we're just excited. I'll say, just excited for the continued conversations. I'll leave it there, but there's been more interesting pieces. So we're looking forward to the second phase of this work.
Yeah. So I'll just wrap up with one other question that you folks preempted in your report. Of course, you know, folks are going to ask how you pay for all these recommendations. So Carmina, maybe tell me a little bit about that section of the report, how you kind of wrap up with how you would action this.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think a really important thing to just bring up when we talk about the question of how will we pay for this, because it seems like our recommendations might be costly or very ambitious in terms of spending. But our main kind of point for that is, if we say that we can't afford a recovery that focuses on equity, then that means that we're not going to have a robust and resilient economic recovery at all. So in that sense, it's even more costly to not undertake this spending now, because we know that it's what is needed in order to assist our society and our economy to restart in a sense, and restart in a better way than it was before. What this pandemic has shown us is that when we want to spend that money, then we can. And if you want to create long-term benefits, like bringing people out of poverty, bringing people out of unemployment, ensuring better health outcomes across society, then that spending can be done. The political will just has to be there. Something else that you mentioned is that we have evidence that a lot of the ideas that we brought up actually bring our economy returns, and a lot of returns, much more than the spending that's undertaken. So there's a study that's frequently cited that we included in our report, which refers to Quebec's accessible daycare program. So there's a study that found that for every $100 that was spent by the Quebec government on affordable daycare, $104 was returned to the government, and then there was a $43 windfall federally. So in general, there's tremendous payback for better quality services for people. That investment just has to be made up front. And something that we also talk about is in the report is taxation and the inequality that has come about from our current tax system, how tax benefits more frequently benefit men than women. And so we do have to do some, we think it's important to do some rethinking around policies like that and taxing the very wealthy and how that could bring back enormous benefits for society in general. There are so many different ways in which making these investments now can lead to benefits for the country's future and for everyone across the country, but it has to be there, that will have to be there to just undertake that.
I think you make such a great point about, you know, investment now and long-term benefits, and you know how some of the existing structures are already disadvantaging some of these changes from actually being made. So I think very, yeah, kind of tangible ways that we can look at these pieces. My last question is actually very simple. What have I not asked you that you think listeners need to know about this plan? Anjum?
Sure. So one of our pillars in our plan is bolstering small businesses. And I think people, you know, are often surprised by the majority of corporations in Canada are small to medium-sized enterprises. And so one of the interesting outcomes or outputs of this plan's launch has been such an appreciation from the chambers of commerce across the country. So we've actually reached out and shared the plan. And we've actually seen recognition like, oh, you're seeing our struggle. You're seeing, because oftentimes there is this thought that civil society and the corporate sector and public service and elected officials, you know, we're all kind of do our separate things. But I think what this pandemic is showing is you need all players at the table. And I think our engagement in particular, what I'm really excited for with the corporate sector, the public service and civil society, with elected officials, I think there is going to be something hopefully not only in what we're asking for, but how we get there, that this plan is also starting to shepherd. So definitely encourage people, especially that corporate engagement that we're starting to see, that's been really surprising and really promising, and we're looking forward to exploring that more.
Amazing. Carmina, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, just to finish, I think I'd like to really emphasize how the recommendations that we're putting forward for the most part have been recommendations that have been discussed for decades or even, you know, centuries from people who have faced oppression and inequity in Canada. And so in that sense, we're not exactly bringing forward anything that's like extremely new. We're just trying to put forward that this is the moment that these changes are so crucial to be put forward. So everything from, as Anjum said, ensuring that small businesses are bolstered, to implementing calls to action in the Truth and from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the report from the Commission for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls. Like, all of these recommendations that have been put forward for some time will help our society be stronger and will help our economic recovery. It's just, we really are trying to put forward that now is really that time, that the time for this change to be made, and we don't want to miss this moment.
For folks who are interested, the report will be linked in the description to this episode, so you'll just be able to click on that and head right over. I want to thank you both so much for this conversation. Like I said at the onset, I've been looking forward to it so much. This is the report I wanted to be written. I don't know if this is like the manifestation or law of attraction, right? It's putting it out into the universe and it'll come. But it's such a tremendous piece of work, and I want to congratulate you both and your organizations on pulling it together. And I wish you luck in the next stages of this report moving forward.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for sticking with us. I want to thank our sponsor, Glass Sky. Glass Sky works to help the next generation of leaders make the most of their talents and contributions to society and the workplace in powerful ways. They work with progressive employers who want to embrace diversity and gain a deeper understanding of the changes they are facing as their leadership profiles rapidly shift to one of millennial and increasingly female. Visit their website, glassguy.org, to learn more. And if you liked this episode, share it. You can connect with us on social media at FemWonk, and I'll see you next time.